Reggie.
And I'm Brian.
And this is R&B Talks.
R&B Talks.
The worst singing possible by my friend Brian. You're welcome.
I never claimed to be an R. Well, you know, I guess I could be an R&B artist. I mean, we do have auto-tune and crazy crap like that. We could probably make it sound decent.
Oh, yeah, you could.
At least get a YouTube hit out of it.
Yeah. And just do like normal. All the. Yeah. It's crazy, man.
Reggie?
Yes.
How was your week, sir?
Has it been a week? It hadn't been a week.
You're messing up the vibe, man.
Has it been a week?
You're messing up the vibe, man.
So, just saying, it hadn't been a week.
How has your 4 days been? That better?
It's fine, man. It's all good. I'm done working today, so I'm happy about it.
I'd like to introduce you to fashionable Reggie. Like, you're looking all good.
No.
Got your loafers on, your good blue jeans, your button-down shirt, got your red pipe, which is very cool, by the way. Looking all fancy.
Yeah, I feel like what was in the front of the closet today.
It was it was as simple as it was the next clean thing. Is that what you're telling me?
This is a recent acquisition. My shirt is because it was right there from where I had hung it on in the closet, and my jeans were just washed, so they were right there. Hence the well, yeah, there they are. I'll just grab that.
That looks right.
There we go.
That looks right.
Well, I was in a hurry today. I didn't get a chance to even go outside and do my thing like I normally do. I mean, it was like I got done with work and I ate real quick and I changed clothes and you got here. That's it.
That seems very full.
I've been at my office since early this morning and didn't get out until late. And I just have been on just today. So, yeah.
I get it. I get it.
But I don't know, man. It's this is different because we are recording this on a Tuesday instead of a Thursday. So that's a little odd, but here we are.
It's trying to
infect our chi, but we're not letting it.
I am not letting anything infect my chi.
It's because you're smoking a cigar because you never do it until you get here.
Nobody. Actually, you know what? Smoked a cigar yesterday, too.
How dare you?
Sat on my back deck and after everybody went to bed and enjoyed a cigar and hung out and looked at the stars and managed my schedule. The wife is out of town this week, so Brian has to hustle, hustle, hustle. Hustle, 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 hustle.
So, Brian.
Yes.
Since we seem to, especially you, want to talk about politics, is there anything you want to talk about today concerning Kamala Harris or President Trump? Or
I just, not really.
Okay, good.
It's kind of garbage begetting garbage at this point, right? Like, what are we going to do? What point are we going to belabor today that we haven't already belabored? Other than, I will say, I did watch the whole Oprah thing. It has nothing to do with it being Kamala Harris. I would just be embarrassed as a human being if I behaved that way on national television. And I'm talking about Oprah as well as Kamala Harris. They were both epically ridiculous. So watch for yourself. It's on YouTube. Take a gander. But other than that, man, really, this has just been, I've kind of taken a break from all incoming news media. Haven't checked on anything, read anything. You know, I take these moments where I feel like I have to reset my brain. Like I have to let everything kind of simmer down. I will admit that as of late, politics has upset me a little bit, but mainly because, not because of who our candidates are or any of that crap, but it's more that just the dumb people saying dumb things. And it upsets me that people are so just willfully ignorant. But outside of that, man, I've just been kind of trying to relax, take care of the boys, and prepare myself for tonight's frivolity of information.
I do want to say one thing.
Sweet rock and roll.
Eric Weinstein.
You familiar with him? Very intelligent man, yes.
Yep. So I never knew really who he was, or whatever. Really just happened to see something.
I'm very familiar with him.
Yeah, I mean, I know who he was, but like I never literally paid much attention. So I happened upon a video on the Chris Williamson podcast or show or channel, whatever you want to call it.
Uh-huh.
Which I have no idea who that guy is either. And they were talking about how the question was asked, like, you know, I think Chris asked, like, it's or said, like, Kamala Harris wasn't sophisticated or something like that. And Eric was like, and why would you say that? And he's like, well, just because the way she talks and this and this. But he actually made a really good point.
Lay it on me, dude.
What he was, and I'll kind of, because it's been a minute since I watched this, so bear with me here. I'll put the link in there in the down description. But he said that, you know, he gave an example of like George W. Bush. In his governor debate, he was sharp, like really sharp.
Yeah.
And that when he got into office, it kind of got all folksy. And he used the example of how he says nuclear. It's not nuclear, nuclear.
Nuclear.
Or something like that, yeah, right? I actually don't remember.
I think I've actually listened to this episode, yeah.
Yeah. And he said, you know, he George Bush knows how to pronounce nuclear. He
certainly does.
He knows that. And he is sharp. Now, look, there's the thing about everybody go, but yeah, he goes like, it's a character.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually used the quote, you know, like nothing in politics happens on accident kind of thing, which heard that many times.
Definitely true.
And so, yeah, and he was pointing that to Kamala saying, you know, it's not.
Absolutely. It's not accidental.
This is a character.
Well,
this is a character.
You know, Megyn Kelly made a great point about her that I thought was really kind of insightful. She said that the reason she believed that Kamala Harris struggled with word salad is because when you're lying and you really passionately want to say how you actually feel and you're tamping down those things because you're trying to sell yourself to an American public that doesn't really like you, you're going to struggle.
Yeah. I mean, and he was, and I think that that's a whole point of the whole,
yeah,
for repeating the same thing over and over again.
Well, it's because it's what they give her.
Well, I know because, and you know, and he, but I think the key there at the very, very end of the little segment I watched, don't judge Kamala Harris just on level one. Now, he's got a level of thing, but I think it's very much like you got to look deeper than that first layer.
Yeah, if you're mistakenly thinking that she's stupid because she has trouble vomiting up things that are not actually what she believes, she's held hostage by the people that control the Democratic Party. They're going to tell her what she is and is not allowed to say.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just saying that it's very much this will go into something else we'll talk about later, but this very much goes into, like, you know, there are different levels of perception,
yeah,
and consciousness kind of stuff that you got to be aware of in order to make any kind of.
Would you be referring to a future episode on the veils?
Indeed.
I'm very excited about that episode.
But I just think, man, I think there's a lot of people that are. And I do, this is kind of what I've said all along, that you're going to see the vast majority of like SJWs and stuff like that. They're going to be really loud and they're going to be really obnoxious and they're going to be a lot of them. You think there's a lot of them.
Yes.
But the vast majority that live in the center part of the country, especially, aren't like that. And they, even if they're insane enough to want to vote for Kamala, they're still not like irrational people necessarily. They just don't have all the information as far as
that's true. That's actually true. That's very right? true.
And yeah. So, I mean, I think that's something that we have to keep in mind. If you're just thinking, oh gosh, why is this all, how can they all think like, or why does it seem all crazy? Well, Because they get the crazy, for one thing. And like, the media wants to sensationalize everything. So they're going to get
it
crazy.
It whips you up into a frenzy is what it does.
Yeah. I mean, it just gets you out of control when you
and
look
be,
at it.
And be, also be aware of this. MSNBC, CNN, ABC, Fox News, all of them, they have people on staff that craft the presentation of the news specifically to hit the right nerves, to get the right emotion stirred up.
Well, the word choices for headline.
Yeah. You know, a all lot of stuff. It's all crafted, and there's a very, I'll have to find the documentary. I watched it a long time ago, and it's about how when 24-hour news started, they went out and hired psychologists, psychiatrists, ad execs, all these people. Not the ad execs weren't for advertising. They hired them to pull information about keywords that would trigger people for reaction. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's been like 10 years since I watched this documentary, but it was an amazing that they went out and got all these experts, because they knew that if they just cycled news for 24 hours, after about 2 weeks, everybody would get exhausted with it. And it was, they're reaching. I was watching Fox News the other day, and after about 3 minutes, I turned it off, because I was like, you're just saying the same thing over and over again, but every time you say it, you have a little more panic in your voice.
Well, that's, I never got into it, dude. I never got into the news station thing or whatever, because it did. It was always like, why is this repetitive so much? And well, this, I mean, like we discussed in the propaganda episode, it is part of that. And there definitely is a propaganda tool to use, especially in our political spectrum. But yeah, anyway, it just, I just find it, I just think there's a lot of people that actually say some really smart things and that are actually very, would be good for the public to acknowledge and really take note of. But I think even Bill Maher, I was listening to some of his stuff the other day, even though, look, I think Bill's
very misled.
Well, it's not, I don't think misled, dude. I think it's just the fact of where he is and, like, you know, the crowd he's in, whatever. And he seems to have a legit mind that is that has critical thinking involved in it, which a lot of people don't. But I'd say, like, you know, he gets to the point almost sounding intelligent, and then he'll say something stupid. Like, he was saying how he like wants it all to get, like, the hate to stop and all this kind of stuff, but then say something like Trump's uses some adjective that's kind of abrasive for the word for, like, with Trump. So I mean, like, that doesn't really help anything. And
yeah, but that's basically the premise of everything that he does.
Yeah. It's like, oh, here's some sense, but
I refer to him as sort of an agitator, right? Like, not really a full on, like, MSNBC, Fox News dude, just, but more of an agitator. Like I'm going to poke the bear a little bit, right? Like, but here's, speaking of Eric Weinstein, I watched, there was a recent episode of Joe Rogan where he was on, and, now, this is something I've been reading up on because I've been finding a lot of interest in this, and that is this whole Google kind of mass of destruction that's gone on, where there's been accusations made. And Eric Weinstein, who, he kind of had an emotional meltdown on Joe Rogan, because apparently after he had done some things to... Now, let me preface this by saying I have absolutely no idea if there's any truth to this at all. He didn't provide any evidence. This could just be a man grieving from the loss of his spouse. But he seems to think that the way that she died was very untimely and may have had something to do with the things that he was uncovering about Google and their power in the internet. And it was very shortly after he had spoke about some things where she had died in a very unlikely accident. Not that it's true or it's false, but if you're looking to kind of, it's something I've been studying for a while, is Google's tentacles are kind of reaching into everything with YouTube, and they pretty much own most of everything as far as the internet goes.
I mean, even the show
on
the YouTube platform as it is.
Yeah.
You know,
I don't know if it's true or not. I just thought it was you know, very interesting that a guy of hyper intelligence like him would have kind of an emotional snap on someplace like Joe Rogan, especially, again, provided no evidence to further his claim. There was nothing that was said that I could divide, but he did have some very interesting points on how the internet works and how algorithms work and how some people can be blacked out and some people cannot. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those things are very prevalent. And that's something that I've been reading a lot about. It just interests me to kind of read about these, the way that they have these, what they call black switches, where they can, you know, if there's a term they don't like, they can there's not like a switch, but they can type in an algorithm that will cause that term to be very difficult to find on Google. It won't make it impossible to find, but difficult to find. Now, again, he provided no proof. He gave no evidence. He just said that he was doing studies, but he also said something about needing $50 million, which I don't know what that means either. So very, very interesting, but I don't know that it provided much of a foundation.
Yeah, I mean, well, to be fair here, technologically speaking, yes, Google can do all kinds of stuff with their search engine to make results do all kinds of stuff and to make search terms do this and that. I mean, that's not even a far-fetched thing to say. I mean, they can do that. They can do that all the time. And when you do search terms and stuff in Google, you could see kind of how the result of that from all kinds of different searches during the pandemic and everything else. There was yeah. Obvious things. So I mean, that's not even a question anymore.
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned, because I think I've personally seen it. It's been validated enough times that Now, I think if Google were trying to make a statement, I think he would know. I guess. If you're really trying to make a point to somebody to back off or like you're doing this, so I think you would know it, because otherwise it would be pointless.
Well,
you know, there's that.
That's kind of what I thought, and here's why I say that. And this is in no way demeaning the fact that this man lost his wife. I would be destroyed if I lost my wife. Yep. But if you're the one making the claims and doing the studies, why would they hurt her? Why would you're the source? It seems to me like hurting you would make you more determined to discover things. You know, I feel like there's maybe again. I think
I'll agree.
I think this is a guy dealing with grieving over the loss of his wife.
Yeah,
rightfully so. But
you know, and speaking of grief, it's one of the ways that is allowed to for a man to cry.
Great segue, Reg. Great. Oh. That was 5-star segue, Reg. I got to give it to you.
You're welcome. Well, so today, Brian, we're going to talk a little bit about crying.
All right. So I'm going to tell you today, Reggie, before we start this subject, most days I'm 100% honest. Today I'm 1,000%. So there's some things I'm going to say today that are going to be disagreed with and are going to probably raise some hackles, but I'm going to say them.
Well, let's see. I want to hear something, Brian.
Okay. So.
Okay. Wait a minute. Do we first want to qualify this a little bit?
Yeah, let's do that. Qualify this for me, Reggie. Let's qualify this.
Okay. Now, I think when we talk about crying, there are different, and you know, there's different cry. There's different kind of cries. Like reflex tears, continuous tears, emotional tears are like some of the categories of crying. Okay.
Gotcha.
Now, I'd say like a reflex tear, that's not, I guess there, I would never associate that with crying, but that's like.
All right. So I took a shot in the shin the other day and I had some tears. Not like boohoo crying, like, oh my gosh, I feel like somebody tried to tear off my leg right in the middle where my shin starts.
Yeah.
Those are reflex tears.
Right. And I don't, that's not what I'm talking about. Okay.
That's not what I'm talking about either.
No. Really, really what we're talking about here is the emotional tears.
Yes.
Now, I know the answer to this question, but I ask you because it's fun.
Okay. Go ahead, Reggie. I'm sorry. That was great.
What are some good things about a cry?
You can release anxiety. It can also, crying has been shown in some cases to relieve depression. It can be a vagal nerve release. crying can actually help your vagus nerve relax, which can bring your whole body to a more relaxed state. There's all kinds of benefits, mental, emotional, there's spiritual benefits to crying.
Well, the Bible's not absent of crying.
It is not. There is weeping and gnashing of teeth.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, so how many more times a month would you say a woman in America would cry more than a man?
Yikes. Okay, so before I give you a direct answer, let me kind of preface why I say it like this. I very rarely cry. So I feel like once a month is more than I cry. So it would be hard for me to quantify that answer.
Okay, so speak. This was on Harvard, EDU.
Leave it to Harvard, man.
They said American women cry 3.5 times each month, while American men cry 1.9 times each month, which seems really high to me. Now, the thing is, maybe I don't know if they're encompassing all the reflex of tears and all that kind of stuff, but even so, I don't think I'd do that anyway. So that was already high. Now for everybody's benefit.
Okay, I was about to say that seems excessive.
Well, I know, but for everybody's benefit, we are both very not crying dudes.
No. Well, and there's things that I have to ask when you tell me that number. Like, number one, did they quantify mental health issues? Did they quantify the people that they studied? Did they recently have, you know, personal losses, whatever's going on? That's a blanket statement. So it's kind of hard to quantify how a guy cries 1.9 times a month and a woman cries 3. Whatever times a month.
Yeah. I don't know. Right? I mean, cause
my mother suffered from mental health issues. She cried almost daily.
Yeah. I mean, and that's what I was trying to think of myself. Like, I don't think I can remember, like it wasn't in the we're talking, gosh, man. I mean, at least a year. Man, I don't know. Hold on. Let me think about this, dude. I'm trying to think of it. I don't know. But it's been a long time, right? It's not like I cry even in 1 month. I'm probably not going to. It's not like a monthly thing.
I might cry once every couple of years.
I don't know. Maybe. I mean, there's
if like, I was to like break it down numerically, maybe once every couple of
years. There's grief. That's been the majority of it. There has been points in my life where there was something that really, really touched me. Like, you know, in a really positive way or something.
I remember the last time I cried. It's when Caleb got baptized. Well, tears of joy, man.
There you go.
My son gave his life to God, man. How could that not move you emotionally?
Yeah. I mean, like, so for me, it's stuff like that, right? It's not like, what they kind of say here, in that same Harvard article, that it's an important safety valve. Like, it really, like, if you get too much inside, that can be the release of that emotion and stuff through that. But I don't know. I did a lot of research on crying because I was frankly just curious. But you know, okay. So let me say this. There's a Harvard article in here, a Harvard Health article. There's a couple of Psychology Today ones. And so let me just go through a little bit of this so that we can get to really what's important.
Lay it on me.
So we already talked about how it can be a release valve, how it can be good for you. According to the University of Queensland, psychologist Lear Sharman, after a crying episode subsides, about 70% of people recall that crying was good for them, most often as a feeling of relief or catharsis. Okay. The percentage goes down, though, when people are asked to think only about the last time they cried, for women on the day that they cried. So the jury is out, really. It doesn't, you know, they kind of didn't really get conclusive about whether it really helped or not. And there was one really interesting thing they said, too, was there may be no direct support for crying's ability to promote biochemical changes, although it may help you take steps to reduce your sadness. So that was the clinical study they did. They said really it might not have any like real biochemical effect, but that it could, you know, possibly, but you know, that kind of thing. So in here's what I'll say this. In this article called "Is Crying Good for You?" Right? So they give some tips to have a genuinely good cry.
All right. I'm very interested in hearing this, Reggie. I really am.
I know.
Tips on a good
you
cry.
You are on your edge of your seat with this one, Brian. I know you are. Cry for your own pain, not just for other people.
Okay.
Number one, let yourself cry over spilt milk. Number two, don't set a time limit on tears. Pick up where you left off. If you have to keep a stiff upper lip at some point, later on, let it out, continue your cry, and speak only kind words to yourself. Watch for self-critical and invalidating self-talk. I'm not a big deal. It's too sensitive. I'm too sensitive. Big boys or big girls don't cry. Instead, say something like, "I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
I'm with you. I love you."
Love yourself.
And then number six, cry in public. So.
Hang on a second.
Yeah.
All right. Now, hold on.
Give me some Kirby thoughts
here, bro. Hold on. How is weeping in public beneficial? I'm sorry. I got to know.
Okay.
Not that I'm particularly against it, but that just sounds irrational.
You may be surprised that many people will be drawn to you. Your tears make you vulnerable and therefore no threat to others. Kindness is a frequent response to public tears. Yeah. So in other words, cry because you want
attention.
People to, yeah.
All right. So, all right. I want to put some warnings out there for men. And in no way is what I'm saying me telling men not to cry. All right. I have cried and I can remember many an occasion I cried. Grandmother died. My uncle died. My brother Chris died. Those were terrible moments for me, and tears came because those were people that I was very close to and that I loved very much. But men, we have to be careful. And one of the reasons is it's almost a socio-political thing in the sense that regardless of all of the left-wing crazy ideological garbage that's going on right now, men who weep a lot are not looked upon as strong men. They're often seen as weak.
Yeah, because
say that they are, but there is a socioeconomic cost to weeping a lot for men.
But the answer to that, though, what you'll find is that that's a cultural thing that needs to be eradicated, and that's what the whole that's actually part of that whole like woke ideology is kind of like, you know, you want to tear down these cultural peer pressures to be that kind of masculine is toxic kind of nonsense. That's the same level as where this, that comes
I don't
from.
Know that really though has anything to do with masculinity in general, right? Like if a guy kicks in our front door and is going to rob us and my wife looks over and I begin to weep, I lose points at that point. Right. If you know, bro, what I'm saying,
bro,
like, and I have met guys, right, that'll weep at the drop of a hat, and I'm not knocking on them, dude. You obviously feel very deeply and emotionally. I don't know what that's like in a lot of cases. I have a tendency to become more emotional when I'm tired or when I'm under tremendous stress, but I don't know that my response is crying. Could it be if the stress was tremendous enough or the anxiety of the situation were heavy enough? Sure. That's possible. But for me, this whole subject that we're talking about, it's healthy to cry, but as we are putting on a podcast, and you and I both value stoicism with men,
yep,
crying can have a negative cost for men like us, right? As we are not, you and I both know we're not weepy men.
No.
And men in general, you know, it's very funny. I was reading an article about a percentage of divorces that happen in America, and a lot of those divorces, the women in their relationship begin to require that their men be more emotional. Men give in, become more emotional, and later the women go, well, I divorced him because I no longer saw him as a masculine figure. I saw him as a weeper, for lack of a better term, right? Like, I think appropriate times to cry are times of deep emotional sadness, loss of a loved one, loss of a pet, man. My grandfather, let me tell you, my grandfather is the most stoic human being you'll ever meet in your life. He's cried twice in the entire time I've known him, and he's 88 years old. Cried when his wife died, and cried for like a minute. And then when
that's impressive.
We had a dog. We rescued this dog from like some lady's backyard. It was starving. They had abandoned the house. They had left the dog there. We got him, brought him to my grandfather. My grandfather took him in, had him his name was Dew for whatever reason. My grandfather, I think we had him for 15 years. He died. Didn't cry when he died. But when my uncle bought him a new dog, he wept. Because at that point, my grandmother was gone and he had no companionship. So when the new dog was brought in, he wept. Twice in the 88, or in the 40 plus years that I knew him, I'd only seen him cry twice.
Okay, so there's an artofmanliness.com article.
Okay.
Here's when they say it's okay to cry. I have some few points on this subject myself, but I thought it's funny to register these. The death of a loved one, obviously, that was one we both would agree on. The death of your beloved pet. There you go. There's another one. When you first see the new life you and your wife created. So when your child is born.
Yeah, I cried when my kids were born. I sure did.
When you propose to the love of your life and she says yes.
I did not cry during that.
I didn't either. At the altar as you get married. I didn't
did
do that.
Did not cry. I was stunned. My wife was beautiful when we got married in the wedding dress and all those things. I was stunned. I didn't cry.
When your beloved car truck, especially your first one, gets totaled. Haven't done that.
No.
Visiting sites that pay tribute to those who laid down their lives for others. Now, okay. That's definitely one that you could see. That's valid. Yes. I'm not saying I have done that, but I'm saying that's completely and totally valid. Especially
emotional when I hear taps.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, when my grandfather was buried and, you know, we had this 21-gun salute and all that stuff. I mean, come on. That was something else. Describing a really spiritual experience. So, in other words, that can. And I know a lot of very tough Christian brothers who have, when they've told their testimony about something or other and in the middle of it, there's a little hiccup, you know, that's fine. Not going to get that. Now I'll have some more to say about that later. As an athlete, after the final game match event that you will ever play in. Right.
Yeah. Or if you win like a world championship, like a Super Bowl.
I mean, that's gotta be, but again, I think that's an emotional, like it's so
that's
much
a joy.
You need a release of that point. Yeah. While watching any of the following movies, and I think this is funny. Field of Dreams.
Okay.
Brian's Song.
Okay.
Shawshank Redemption.
Okay.
The Pride of the Yankees. Old Yeller. Definitely.
Yeah.
Iron Giant. Yeah. No. Life is Beautiful. Saving Private Ryan. Rudy.
Oh, yeah. Cried at Rudy.
Braveheart. Dead Poets Society. Friday Night Lights. We Were Soldiers. Gladiator. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, The Champ, Glory, and It's a Wonderful Life. Those are the valid reasons they give to watching those movies.
All right, I'm going to make a confession. Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay. I cried at Rudy, for sure. I cried at Old Yeller. There is a movie I watched, and I wept in that movie. And I'm going to confess right now, Legends of the Fall. When his brother died in war and he had to come back and he was sitting at the edge of his brother's grave after he had tried to save him during this battle and he is weeping at the loss of his brother.
That was it, huh?
I cried.
That drove
because
you.
I was like, dude, Brad Pitt, man, look, I'm not a huge fan, but bro, in that scene, he broke me. He broke me, man. I cried. Not gonna lie.
Oh, that's funny. Okay, so, but now, here's when it says not okay for a man to cry.
All right, sweet. This is the one I'm interested in hearing.
When your favorite sports team loses. Yeah, don't cry. You look like an idiot.
Get over yourself.
When those around you are looking to you as a source of calmness and strength, of course, don't cry.
Then amen to that one.
To the point of irrational thinking or paralysis when you have a job to do. Yeah. When you don't get your way, when you're frustrated in baseball, there's no crying in baseball. Fantastic quote, by the way.
Yes, there is.
And during these falling movies, you're not allowed to cry. Beaches, Steel Magnolias, Little Women, Jerry Maguire, The Notebook, and Ghost. There's many more I could probably add to that
list. Okay, I'm going to confess. Have you seen The Notebook?
I don't actually think I have.
Okay. I'm actually haven't told my wife this yet, but she's been on me to watch this movie with her, so I'm going to watch it with her. She says it's a guaranteed weeper. I don't know. According to artofmanliness.com, we cannot cry during Notebook.
But let me, okay, so my here's the thing with me. I'm very empathic.
Yeah?
I'm very empathic.
You are actually for someone who's as stoic as you are very you connect to energy very well.
Here's why. I was raised by four freaking women. I mean, come on.
Yeah, same with me.
So I was always around that. But it's now that I've gotten older, I kind of understand this whole thing where I have my father's side of the family who is very like extremely stoic.
Yeah.
Where, you know, it's there's nothing but stoicism. Like, you know, my. Whoa, you know, it's kind of like your grandpa. It's that, right? In pretty much everything. I get a lot of that from there. And then I have this other side that's kind of empathic and everything else. So what's happened is when I've gotten older is that I have this always battle where I'll feel immensely about something. Mm-hmm. But then it's like the my dad's side just like kicks me in the face and says, no.
Yeah.
And so for me, it's a control thing. It always has been. And honestly, that's kind of where I'm at with crying anyway. So I look at it like, it's almost like that whole thing that, if you can be violent, but you control it, that means you're actually being,
that's a good man.
That's a good man.
You know, weakness is not valor.
To me, that just means you're in control of yourself. Okay.
Yes.
So for me, that's kind of where I'm at with my emotions and like crying and all this stuff. I am in control of, and that's part of it for me. So when it comes to like, cause there's a lot of movies that I feel really strongly or connect with or something.
Yeah.
And I'll feel this urge and I'm like, no, that's not, you don't cry over that. Right. It's just, that's now you could argue like, well, in most of these people that wrote these articles in Psychology Today and would say, I'm doing it wrong. I should actually release that. But I don't think so. I think it helps me practice control. So that's where I'm at, Brian. I know that's different, but that's really where I'm at.
Well, let me ask you this question. Here's one. Have you ever cried and been surprised that you were crying?
No.
Not once. You've never had a moment where you've shed a tear and you're like, dude, I'm not really sure why I'm crying.
Okay. I've shed a tear and gone, that's dumb. I should not have done that. I've done that, but I've known why. Okay.
All right. So
here's a good one.
Okay.
My mother used to sing, what was the song called? Shenandoah River or something. You sing that song all the time, right? Around the house and
great
stuff.
Great song.
So I went to try to find it one day. And this wasn't even, this was like a couple of years ago, right?
Yeah.
Not even realizing. I was like, you know, what's that song my mom used to sing? So I went and I found like the Morbid Tabernacle Crier, like did a song of it.
Oh, dude, super emotional.
So I turned it on, and as soon as that first freaking line, I was a bawling mess, right? Knew it, but I didn't expect that, right? It's just, that was like, you know, just out of nowhere, right? That's something that caught me off guard, but I knew why, you know?
It kills me how much I like you and are, because my grandmother was a gospel fan, Elvis especially. And the Christmas after she died, I was sitting in the living room of the house that my wife and I were renting. My kids were, and my wife were out Christmas shopping. And How Great Thou Art by Elvis came on. I just remember, I'm going to say it, I lost my shit for about 5 minutes. Like I cried, like I tears streaming cried, because every single wonderful memory that I ever had with my grandmother just kept running through my head. And I was just a new father. I was still trying to find my way as that. And I just remembered all these things coming into my head. Have you ever had an occasion where you cried, but you left the room
because
you knew?
I mean, at my grandfather's funeral was one example. I held it together pretty good, but there was a point where I had to walk out of the room. I had to. Yeah. It just had to happen. But yeah, I mean, that's an example.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, though, it's not a practice for me. My wife will tell you, you know, it's just not. And look, here's my thoughts on this, man. I mean, I think it's cool if you feel things deeply and, crying as a guy, if you feel things that deeply where it's a cry thing, but I think that it becomes a problem if you can't control it. And that's where I am with that whole control thing.
That would tell me that you need to put into practice a little bit more self-control at that point.
Exactly.
Yeah. If you're weeping uncontrollably constantly, I think that as we get older in life, I have met a lot of older men in their 70s and 80s who cry probably more. I don't really hold it against those dudes, because if they've lived a long, good life and they're, a lot of them cry because of joy when they're feeling very joyous.
I don't know.
A lot of them cry when they're reflective. I don't really hold that against men of that age, because there's a different dynamic in life at that point, right? Like you're seeing things in a completely different light if you're making it, especially if you're a grandfather and still a husband, and you're seeing all of the things that you've poured into your children start to come forward. It's almost, I would say, a cry of pride, right? Like, look what I've, that sounds egotistical, look what I've accomplished, right? But
what would you say I guess the question I'm looking to answer here is like, do we feel like the quote unquote old fashioned societal pressure to not cry as a man? Do we feel that's valid or not?
I feel like it's not a really, I don't feel like you can really label it that way. Let me say why. I don't feel societal pressure to not cry. I think when you have a man who feels a level of societal pressure to do one thing or the other, you might want to unplug from that, whatever portion of society you've plugged yourself into, in the sense of, I guess I don't attune to society's measure, right? Like, I can think back on the times I've cried and it's been appropriate for whatever reason, right? You know, I think if you're crying all the time, how sincere is it? And how much of it is a show?
But I know when growing up, it was always, boys, don't cry. Cry baby, blah, blah, blah. You got made fun of when you cried, right? And I think this depends on who your dad is, which I know for you is a little difficult, but well, I was raised like that. Now he didn't, my father was not a very like, he didn't ever, I shouldn't say like he, you shouldn't, but he always said, you gotta be a tough guy, be man, be a man, that kind of thing, which yeah. I think is valid.
Yeah. To a degree. Yes. I don't think I think some of it's a little unnecessary, but I think it's,
but that's the old, a valid point. I mean, our
old school, right?
Like, yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of validity to it, but not everything.
Yeah.
Now, but cause I mean, the thing is like, I guess for me, if I think about, some of the stuff that a man should be able to do, like, you know, if you really, like we've been talking about, like the way that he is supposed to be the foundation of the family, how he's supposed to be the rock.
Yes.
The provider and the protector and, well, provider is a little different now in 2024 because I don't think that's necessarily the man's job, but definitely protector. I still think you can't take that mantle away for most men. But anyway, so, I mean, I think that when you want to always, I think I'm going to relate it to this way. I want my family to think that I'm a strong, potent, potential for violent person who they feel safe around. I think when you start allowing yourself to cry a lot, especially around, well, let's just talk about in your family unit, then all of a sudden they look at you like now you're more emotional. You got, dad's, he cries a lot. That doesn't make them feel, I don't think, necessarily like you're going to be able to handle your
business. Doesn't make them feel safe.
And it goes back to this control thing. I kept coming back to that when I was reading about all this crying stuff. It's very much like a control thing for me. It's just like, look, you got to take control of your emotions. Or you really just need to like have a better, a different perception of things or something. I don't know. It's been hard for me to kind of wrap that around a little bit, but
well, and let's qualify that too. I mean, a lot of men are put in situations where tremendous amount of stress can cause different reactions. But for me, it's always been when it's appropriate. Like it's never been, have I had moments where I felt emotional and thought I might cry, but I just go, dude, not the time, right? Not the time.
That's what I mean. You control yourself.
And I feel like but this also goes back to this, I hear this a lot. Let your emotions go. No, that's dangerous. That's not safe. Not for you as a man, it's not safe. Let's take your family out of the picture. If you cannot control your emotions, that can be signs of a deeper problem, right?
Yeah, of course.
And the one thing that I know about you and I, we've known each other long enough to know that we're good at self-assessing.
It's true.
Like we're good at self-assessing when we're out of control, when our environment's out of control, when our... And that's something that we've learned over years of just maturing as men. I go back to a situation. It's very rare that I've broken down in front of groups of people. When my Uncle Kenny passed away, I struggled with it. As a matter of fact, I struggled with it for a few years. And I began to cry at his funeral. I couldn't control it. Like there was no stopping it. It was just overwhelming. Not this sobbing cry, but just tears, and I remember my Uncle David, and God bless him. He's still one of my favorite human beings on the planet, will always be. I owe a huge portion of who I am as a man now to him. He told me to stop it. And I got really mad when he told me that. I never told him this. He's probably going to watch this. But I realized later that he had lost his brother and he was trying to hold it together for his dad, for me, for every man in the room. And he and I are very close. And when he saw me break, And it wasn't until later, almost a year later, at an event that I actually saw him shed a tear about his brother. And I feel like at that point he felt safe to go ahead and let that go. Here's what I'll say. When is it good for men to cry? That's a very hard thing to quantify for every man. You and I will cry over different things than the guy across the street will cry over. I will only say that if you are so out of control that everything makes you cry, you may want to seek some counseling. You may want to do some self-assessment and figure out what's going on in your life and in your mental state and your emotional state that's causing you to be that way. Because there's a trigger somewhere, right? There's a psychological trigger that's causing you to do that. You need to really look at that and say, is this healthy? Is this healthy for me? Is this healthy for my wife, girlfriend, children, brothers, sisters, moms, dads, uncles, whatever it is? I don't think there really is an appropriate moment to cry. I think that if you're truly in control of your emotions, you're going to know when that time comes, right? You're going to know. Just like you said when your grandfather passed away, you did really well, but I would dare say that you probably picked the appropriate moment to let those things go.
I mean, there was, okay, yeah. I mean, I walked out. My grandmother was there. I mean, but at my grandmother's funeral, I was crying. At my dad's funeral, I was crying. But let me clarify this, though. Not sobbing, wailing thing.
Yeah, just tears.
Just tears.
Just tears. I think for men, for me.
I've never actually sobbing wailed, by the way. I don't think I've ever done that. Actually, never, no. I know.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever lost my mind and just blubbered.
Lord
help me.
No, I haven't done
that. But I think that's, for men, that's the appropriate way to cry. If there is an appropriate way to cry, is it's almost a sign of respect. You know, it's almost a sign of respect to cry for someone that you revered in your life.
Well, and what's funny is too, in my dad's funeral too, like, I was fine. It's like this pretty much anytime. If I see another dude crying, I'm probably going to lose it. If I see another dude break and start crying, I'm going to freaking lose it. I'm going to have to fight everything I have not to cry with this brother.
Well, but that's not necessarily a bad thing.
I know,
right?
But like, I don't want to. Like, a lot of times some dudes be crying at nothing, and I'm like, damn it, why are you crying? You know. Damn it. But like, you know, at my dad's funeral, they were like, has anybody else want to say anything? And my nephew, Finn, gets up and pulls my brother up there. And then my brother loses it, man. Because he's like, you little shit, you brought me up here. Now I lost it. And so it was like that point that I lost it. But, it, you know, it was like, but yeah, it was.
All right,
was
I got to know which brother.
Ricky.
Ricky?
Yeah.
Oh, dude, Robbie, I could understand.
Well, we were already done. I think Robbie, you know, but yeah, I mean, but that's what I'm saying. That's an appropriate, but that's cool. That's appropriate way to, that's it, right? I mean,
I'll tell you something. When we were going to the abortion rally disguised as a men's meeting and you played your dad's music for me, I didn't cry, but I got really emotional when I first started hearing him sing. Because well, I knew your dad is this really kind of funny. And I say this lovingly, kind of crotchety, just dude that just, I tripped, I laughed every time I was around him. And then when you put that music in, I had a holy crap moment. Cause to me, I got to see a side of your dad that I had never seen.
Yeah.
I'd never seen that. When you played that music, I had to swallow the knot in my throat for a second.
I didn't cry when I heard it. It did choke me. I mean, like, it's like that little choke up kind of thing.
Yeah,
that was all it was.
That's an amazing moment.
Yeah. Like,
I can tell you that if I'm logging amazing moments that you and I have had experienced together, it's when you played that album, dude. Are you kidding me?
That was
the abortion rally disguised as a men's meeting?
Yeah, it really was.
That was so weird.
But yeah, I mean, you know, there is definitely like, I guess I'm just saying for even in 2024, I think it's just, it's another way for men to practice control and really just, man, keep in mind that it's not bad. And yeah. I don't really look at a dude who's crying about something and think bad about him. But if like every, but it's like going, but if I do
every
think,
time I see him, he's crying about something.
Then I'm going to be like, bro.
Yeah, I'm going to be like, you need to get it under control.
You're all right.
I mean, need to work some stuff out.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I'm saying. Like, it's really about control. It's the same thing with what I keep going to these churches and like the pastor keeps crying every day on Sunday. Like, bro, I've been there, right? Where the gospel message has captured him and broke me down. I mean, I've been there, right? Yeah. But I'm not. I don't foresee me being now. Okay, look, I say this. Yes, I could get in a spot where I'm actually preaching, and I'm emotionally invested, and that does end up with a tear or something. But it's probably not. It's not going to be every Sunday. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I definitely. Well,
I mean, you know, you and I both went to a church where the pastor tended to cry quite a bit.
Yeah.
And that, not that I discount that at all. I mean, dude, if you were feeling it, bro, I gotcha. But, you know, I get emotional when I hear someone's testimony.
Yeah. I mean, especially if you connect with part of it.
Yeah. Too. If I hear someone up there giving their heart and soul and telling me about how they found Christ and how they were moved into that place in their life, that will move me emotionally. Will I cry? No, but I feel that emotional connection to that testimony. And you know how I feel about testimonies. I feel like that is the biggest just lost powerful tool inside the church is the testimony, an individual's testimony.
Yeah, I mean, I just think that I think it really pulling in the biblical view of this, you know, Jesus wept is one of the most famous freaking sentences ever.
For sure.
I mean, so you can't really argue that. I don't think there's any. And there was many men in the Bible that weren't anywhere close to being what you would call a weak man, were noted as weeping or crying or something. So, I mean, there's obviously a place for men to cry and to let that happen. I mean, it's very common in the Bible. And I don't think you could see with all the range of things that happened in the biblical time. I mean, good grief. There was plenty of opportunity to cry. So I guess that's what I'm saying. Like, you know, even biblically, it's you crying is part of it.
Yeah.
But also in the same token is like, it talks a lot about, you know, you can't let, your tongue is like the rudder of a ship.
Yeah.
You got to control that. Well, if that applies to there, it kind of applies to everything else.
Yeah.
So
sure.
I guess that's where I'm at with biblically about crying, man. It's like, okay, cool. Yes. It's okay. Men are allowed to, you know, express their emotion and relieve their emotion as far as that
goes. I'll never be that guy, right? Like, don't.
Yeah. You get those extremes. I've seen that extreme.
I think we both have.
And it's just, that's not healthy either.
You know? I think that societally, as men, we need to ignore this constant message that we're not emotional enough. I think that's a silly
kind of. I think studies show that that's not true anyway. I mean,
yeah. I think that people who assume that men don't have emotions, I think we feel a very deep well of emotions, but I think we're built to deal with them differently, right?
Yeah, because I mean, look at our function as the biologically, dude. I mean, they're just not the same. It's not so. Yeah. Okay. So, Brian, the next thing I want to get into here, because this is okay. So for all everybody out there. So what we're doing, what I'm going to do is I'm going to introduce something here.
Uh oh.
That will actually blend. We're going to actually do some other things about this. Okay. So I was my daughters were watching this show, and I don't remember what it's called, but it's like a kids' history show, and it. Showed Benjamin Franklin, and they explained how he wrote the Declaration of Independence.
Okay.
And the statement that just caught me off guard, flat out, which I totally just, I've read the Declaration of Independence many times, but you know, you just don't, you know, it doesn't, but this stuck. When he says, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that little statement here. And then he goes on to say, like, that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Yes.
These truths to be self-evident.
Yes.
Huh. Meaning that there's no explicit, like, explanation needed to understand
that these are simply the truth.
This is simply the truth. Simply the truth.
Yes. I agree with that statement.
And it got me to thinking, which is what we talked briefly. It was like, you know what? We need to talk about kind of how that's evolved, like where we are now compared to a self-evident truth. And I don't want to get into like all the philosophical stuff, because we'd be here
for 4 hours.
I mean, good Lord. But I think it's worth talking about, like, what happened to self-evident truth?
You know? Well, I think that's part of this whole, I mean, you can tie all this together. I mean, all right, I'll give you an example. A lot of what you see nowadays, emotional outbursts from our far left men, especially when talking about, you know, feeling someone's pain of loss of identity and things like that. And I do want to put something out here in this. PTSD. It's not a game. I have been with men who have had severe emotional breakdowns from PTSD, being in live wartime, watching friends die next to them. You get a pass, bro. I've never actively been at war, but when I've sat with men who have, and they have explained and talked to me about the horrors that they've seen, I've gotten emotional just listening. I couldn't imagine being someone who was in it, and if they are, and the things that they struggle with. So yeah. But I think a lot of, I want to just say that those men are, you got to pass, dude. From the pain and the psychological damage and the emotional damage, you get a pass, man. But these people, especially men who are, well, they're weeping, politicians especially weeping about, oh, the tragedy of this, you know, young, you know, confused identity person bawling and weeping because that to me is the most insincere form of tears that there is, because you're denying an evident truth and using it to elicit emotional responses to get other people to buy into your non self-evident truth. I think that that's a perfect example of what you're talking about. Emotion can be used as a weapon and can be used to destroy, disguise, and even get rid of the truth. So I think we need to be very careful. But that's never a truer statement, especially in our modern times. What happened to self-evident truths? What happened to stealing ourselves to the self-evident truth so that we don't become an emotional weapon or train wreck to pull other men off of where they should be?
Yeah, I think from a philosophical standpoint, there's been many, 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 many changes in how they view things and latched onto stuff. And I mean, there's a little bit of that. Philosophy to me is just so it's just pretty much whatever you want, you'll be able to find a philosophy for kind of thing really anymore. But like the self-evident truth is really a founding principle of Christianity.
Yes.
In that, you know, and this has been throughout the history of the church and even Old Testament times and everything else. I mean, there's just things that God instills in us that we know are truths because he has done that. And that never went away.
No.
It's just that being man, we tried to quantify that by different means so we could try to push God out of the equation.
Yeah.
And that's what's in the philosophical realm. That's what has happened time and time again. What they kind of qualify this as in philosophy is intuitionism. Intuitionism in ethics, I think, is what the one article's okay. Oh, I got it right here.
Which makes sense.
And so it's like ethical intuitionism is the philosophical version of a self-evident truth. And that really has a lot of things to it. But getting back to this, though, you know, the actual, like, absolutes of morality is one of the key just resounding winning arguments for a creative design and a creator.
Yes.
Because people invariably, a vast number of people will agree on some things that are good and bad.
Yes.
And where does that come from? It's not, you know. It's
good,
not
like, evil, right, wrong, all those
things. Yeah, there's a lot of things that people will agree to, right? Yes. And there's a lot of arguments against, well, that's not from there. That's from, they'll lope it in with evolution or some other kind of nonsense. But at the end of the day, throughout history, we have known what's right and wrong.
Yes.
In societies who are left by themselves without a spiritual compass to guide them will choose all kinds of heinous things and call it good.
Yes.
And we can look back on history and see those too.
For example, the things we do in the name of God.
Now, C.S. Lewis, his moral argument is superb. And there's tried to be a lot of rebuttals against it. And I just never heard any of that that really logically stood up to me, but people try. But anyway, so when I think of self-evident truth, that's really where I go to, is like, we've really thought that we are so smart that we are so superior as humans that we don't need an external to the human condition version of a truth. We can make our own truths. We can decide our own, you know, right and wrong, because I mean, we're human. We're so smart, but we fail constantly of that kind of thing.
Yes.
And I think our founding fathers were smarter than what people give them credit for. And they were, I think what was the last toll? 85% of them were some kind of Christian denomination.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, I mean, we're talking Benjamin Franklin here, that says, you know, he believed in self-evident truth.
Yeah. Well, I mean, think of the foundation of everything that we do, right? Like, you know, self-evident truth lies in intelligent design. It lies in all the things that come forward. And I think you can align emotional recklessness with the abandonment of self-evident truth, right? Because if we allow ourselves to be open to all untrue things, we are allowing ourselves to become out of control emotionally, spiritually, mentally, even physically. So those being said, or that being said, you're right. I think the key to emotional control, and what I mean by emotional control, is not being so open to untruth that you become emotionally out of control trying to deal with all these things that are you're creating in your head, because essentially that's what you're doing, is what allows you to stay within your emotional control, right? There's a heaven, there's an earth, there's a good, there's an evil, there's all these things that we're very sure of. And by allowing ourselves to believe in those inevitable, rock solid, concrete truths, we are more able to control our spirituality, our emotionality, all those things. So I think that's a very true statement.
Yeah, I mean, I think we look back a little bit to Thomas Aquinas. I mean, he was one of them who said, you know, there are some naturally implanted truths and human beings, self-evident. Mm-hmm. He believed the existence of God and God's natural and moral law. Those are the things that were naturally implanted, self-evident in humans. I think we got to understand too. We're like when we get the Declaration of Independence and we get the Constitution, some of the most impressive governing body documents that human history has ever produced,
yes,
come from a Christian origin. Keep in mind that all modern society come from a Christian philosophy. Okay. Yep. This is what happened when you had, you had the spiritual stuff from, like Israel back and went into Rome, and then from Rome you had the Greek influence. So you had Rome created the civilization model from the kind of the reason from, and I don't remember where I read this, from like the Greeks and the spiritual nature from the Eastern the Middle East or whatever. Israel and type of stuff. So that's where Rome came up, and that's how civilization flourished from there.
Yes.
Okay. Everything we owe Christianity that.
Yeah.
So here's the thing. When he's writing these documents, that's really where that's being pulled into and acknowledged that, look, there are some things that you have to acknowledge are innate in every human, and that there is no really extravagant or complex explanation that's needed, that it's just a known fact. It's a known truth. Yes. And so you get into, like, when you study this in philosophy, though, this is where, I mean, like, it's such a rabbit hole.
It is.
to like, look at philosophical. And I had to. That was part of what I studied at Liberty, was, like, there's a lot of different philosophical views that you looked at over the span of human history to see, like, how things were approached and how reason was gathered and where'd logic come from. And I mean, there's all kinds of things, especially when you start talking about a morality stuff, it's that really got twisted in the Enlightenment period and on, especially 20th century type of philosophical ideas. Cause that's when it really started going off the rails as far as, like, you know, Nietzsche and, people like Freud, who had some weird ideas too. And there's all kinds of things that came up in the 20s, and still are, by the way. Yeah, they're still
in practice.
There's still some really weird stuff, but there are people, though, and I'll put this in because there's a Encyclopedia of Philosophy entry about the intuitionism in ethics, which is kind of what we're talking about, a self-image. And there's a few philosophers over time who've agreed to this, but one of the key things I'll note here philosophically is that, you know, for a proposition to be self-evident, it must be clear and distinct, be ascertained by careful reflection, be consistent with other self-evident truths, and attract general consensus, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the philosophical point of what they were saying, what this intuitionism leads to. If it's a self-evident truth, that's what it really needs to be. There's been plenty of other philosophers and stuff over time who've actually said, you know, and believed in stuff like this, but I'm just saying that it boils down to that this idea of a self-evident truth comes way back in history, and is embedded in. And I do think that coincides with the in biblical speak, when it talks about, you know, God is known and puts his the knowledge of him inside everyone. I think that's there. I think that you see a lot of the movements who are quite frankly not considered godly, are why they're so militant with what they do, is because they're searching for this and perpetuating this acceptance by to many to kind of cover up the knowledge that they know it's wrong. I do think that too, but anyway, this is going to lead into this. I want to get into what is truth. And part of that is also talking about some veils, Brian. Yeah. Now, can you tell people what I'm talking about? Yeah. I introduced Brian to the concept.
He did. And now my brain doesn't work right anymore because I'm studying that too. Here's the problem. Reggie gets me on these roads. And then I get on these roads and my brain melts because now I'm on the Nine Veils, which are, it's hard to say what, so far what I've read, it's hard to say what people believe and how they're blinded to the truth. The veils have something to do with that. Truth is concrete. Truth is provable. Truth is historical. Truth is so many things. The easiest way to find out if something is true is there a collapsible point, or what I like to call a blank bridge between A and B? If I'm studying something and you got me, and all of a sudden you give me this piece of it that I can't prove historically, there's no factual basis for what you're saying, all of a sudden that truth collapses. I believe that Christianity is that truth, right? Like there, you know, we can historically track the existence of the characters in the Bible and the people in the Bible. We can historically track the places, the things that went down. We know where the Hill of Skulls is. We know, you know, Jesus is historically someone who existed. I think when you're talking about the different philosophies, Freud, Nietzsche, I think what happens in those is you get to these points where it goes away from being truth to opinion, but they do such a great job of camouflaging one into the other. If you're not paying attention, you'll accept something as truth without proof.
And keep in mind too, when you're in open rebellion against the creator, because you flat out refuse to think such a way, you're looking for every means necessary to explain yourself.
Yeah.
You know,
even faulty, purely philosophical, non-factual ways to explain yourself.
Especially that.
Yeah.
I read another day, speaking of wild untruth, and it was this wicked, just obscene explanation of Adam and Eve, where it's like, well, why wouldn't Adam trust Eve and all this stuff? And it was really this railing against that. And it was just so odd to read that. And it's from an atheist, obviously.
Yeah.
So you get this. And okay, let me say this first. If you're an atheist, or even agnostic, understand that if you come at somebody who's studies theology, mm-hmm. and you spit out stuff that you see in memes and everything online, you look like an idiot.
Yeah.
I want the best for you, but like, you know, when you present stuff, it's really ignorant. And this is what I think they don't understand. So, but I know you got something to say. When you come at somebody who has, especially like there's people who take their entire lives in academia to study theology, which means studying the word, study even particular books of the Bible, they'll choose that kind of thing to study and get deeper and deeper. And you just throw all that out and say you're an idiot to them. You've really just missed the boat. I mean, there's just no arguing with that. There's no point in responding. So hence why I'm not responding on social media to many things. It's really just because it's like, it's no point. It's so foolish and stupid. I don't want to do that.
Well, I think people forget that when you're discussing something, part of the frame of a discussion is bringing facts to the table to back your argument. We've talked about this so many times before, which is willful ignorance. You know, when you're out there quoting memes and quoting, you know, sound bites and God, love me, Instagram influencers and all these people that you're just vomiting up all this. Just, it's basically nonsense.
Well, I guess I'm just saying, just know. It's like, I'm not going to go have a debate with a particle physicist about anything like that.
Yeah.
I would be way out of my depth, right? It's the same thing with theology or biblical stuff. If you throw out something and you want to argue a biblical passage against somebody who's a theologian, and you
prepare
to
lose.
You have no idea. They're not even gonna acknowledge it, for one.
Yeah.
It's not.
And if they do acknowledge it, it's going to be to completely poke holes in everything that you're saying.
So that's kind of why I just don't. I'm not doing that on social media. I'm just not. I started to and I stopped because it quickly occurred to me that it was a waste of my time.
Well, when someone accepts something as truth, it will take a deeply personal experience to change their mind.
And that's why I want to talk about truth, because the thing that we have to, the thing that I asked myself, this has been a long time ago, is like, why do some people not see truth? Like if I've gathered and I'm not that freaking, I'm some genius level, researcher or whatever, but
you're a mad scientist genius.
Mad scientist genius. But if I can find it on the internet without much effort, like to find real data that's not manipulated in some way, because I've searched for it in all kinds of different areas. In some cases it takes a long time depending on the subject. But I'm saying, if I found all this, then why doesn't everybody else?
Because they believe the first thing they see.
I know. But also too, it's because they have a veil. Yeah. And that's that this whole nine veils subject, which we will get into, does help illuminate some differences in why people don't see some things.
Yeah.
It's not very deep. I think the depth of it kind of leaves itself to its own ponderance necessarily, but I do want to bring it up because I think we should talk about truth.
Yeah.
What it is. And how we see it, and how we go about it, all that kind of stuff. So that's where we're going.
Yeah.
And tune in next time for the truth and nine veils.
Okay. Indeed. All right.
So that'll be next week. So if you enjoyed watching what you watched or listened to,
you enjoyed watching.
Link, like, and subscribe.
And comment.
Many
and
things.
Just don't say ridiculously mind-numbing things.
Say whatever you want.
Expect a response.
Say whatever you want. It's cool.
I would encourage you, I encourage people to, and you actually had a lot to do with how I study things, Reggie. Touch on multiple sources. Don't type in, why do I believe? Don't type in, why do I believe in atheism? And then, the Webster's Encyclopedia definition of atheism pops up and that's your whole argument. Source it out. Look at more than one thing. Whatever you believe, if you really want to find out whether it's truth or whether it's garbage, you've got to get into it. The reason that I believe, and I know this is redundant, that Kamala Harris would be a terrible president is not because I'm just not a fan of Kamala Harris. I don't care
who she is.
She has a very poor record. She has been shown to make very poor decisions. She has been shown to not be able to be substantive in discussions and debates. I have looked at the whole frame and picture. And what I see tells me that that's not a good thing from multiple sources, not from, Billy Bob and his, funny Instagram video about how bad Kamala Harris is. It might be funny, but it don't necessarily tell me the truth.
Well, we said it too. It's not like we're both cheerleaders of Trump either.
Yeah, I don't like him either.
I've had some pretty stark, heavy criticism of the man, but I'd have to look at, okay, how the country run when he was president.
Yeah.
How's it ran when she's been vice president? And there's a really stark contrast between the two.
And it's all factual. We're not like, this is not a personal vendetta, right? I'm not like Kamala Harris. That's not it.
But we are anti-woke. I mean, that's the thing. I'm against,
super anti-woke.
That's what I mean. So we are against that political agenda. At the end of the day, if you're a proponent of all this nonsense from the left, that's what they're cheerleading.
Yes.
I'm not going to support that. Not going to subscribe.
Yeah.
Period.
Not at all.
We're R&B Talks.
I'm Brian.
And I'm Ridden.
Thanks for watching.
Bye-bye.